following message was recorded at Antioch Presbyterian Church, an historic and charter congregation of the Presbyterian Church in America, ministering to upstate South Carolina since 1843. Come and visit us at the crossroads of Greenville and Spartanburg counties. Experience our past and be a part of our future. For more information, visit antiochpca.com.
The following is a recording of Whatsoever Things Are True, Classic Discourses on Truth by Dr. James Henley Thornwell, Discourse 3, The Love of Truth. In my last discourse, I endeavored to demonstrate that the love of truth, as such, is a duty from the constitution of the human mind. The aptitude of truth to enlarge and expand it, the intimate connection betwixt the culture of our moral and intellectual powers, and the impossibility of vindicating the obligation of specific forms without recognizing the obligation of truth in general. I was led to show that we are responsible for our opinions insofar as we are responsible for the motives and influences under which we form them, that the operations of the understanding have a moral character, inasmuch as the impulse of curiosity, like all our other springs of action, is subject to the direction and control of the moral faculty. The love of truth for itself was evinced to be the law in conformity with which all our intellectual processes should be conducted. The end of every inquiry should be knowledge, the aim of every investigation simple and unadulterated truth. To guard against the possibility of misapprehension, it may be well to add that, in inculcating the love of truth as a moral obligation, it is by no means my purpose to imply that all men are bound to know all truth. There is a great difference betwixt asserting that nothing should be sought which is not the truth, and that everything which is the truth is the appropriate pursuit of every understanding. There are departments of inquiry from which the natural limitation of our faculties precludes us. There are subjects upon which we are incompetent to speculate from the want of congruity betwixt them and the constitution of our own minds. And as long as our powers remain what they are, they must forever be to us an unknown world. All knowledge, as I have elsewhere demonstrated at some length, note, see Second Review of Morell's Philosophy of Religion in Volume 3 of this collection, and note, is relative in its nature and phenomenal in its objects. Whoever, therefore, would seek to penetrate into properties of things to which our faculties are not adjusted, overlooks a fundamental condition of the possibility of knowledge, and his conclusions are entitled to no more respect than the speculations of a blind man upon colors, or of a deaf man upon sounds. There are conditions in the objects corresponding to conditions in the subjects of knowledge. One thing is set over against another, and beyond the limits of this correspondence it is folly to push our inquiries. Omniscience is the prerogative of God alone. Men and angels, all creatures, however exalted, must be forever doomed to write over boundless regions of truth, quote, Hades, an unseen world, end quote. There is light there, light in which God dwells and rejoices, but which created eyes are not fitted to receive. To inculcate the obligation of universal knowledge is to tell men to forget that they are men, and to urge them upon attempting to be gods. It is to inculcate the most daring presumption to sanctify intolerable arrogance and blasphemy. The duty to seek knowledge can never transcend our capacities. We are not bound to know what our faculties are unable to grasp, and the attempt to become wise beyond the laws of our nature has always been rebuked in the history of philosophy with the most signal and disastrous failures. Neither is it the duty of all men to seek all the knowledge which is attainable by any. The circumstances of multitudes are such that their inquiries are necessarily confined within narrow limits. Their time and attention are taken up with pressing cares, and the exigencies of life leave no leisure for abstracted speculation. The progress of knowledge, too, requires that those who are devoted to its interests should divide their labors. Some should be engaged in one department, some in another. Some should give themselves to the sciences, some to the arts, some to elegant letters, and others to the severer studies of logic, metaphysics, and morals. In this way, the march of humanity is accelerated, the general condition of society is improved, though no single individual can ever hope to be abreast of the whole culture of the age. What particular department of speculative truth each man shall select for himself, and how far he shall prosecute his labors, are questions to be determined by the circumstances in which he finds himself placed. All that I assert in any case is that it is an indispensable duty in whatever inquiries we engage to aim only at the truth. We are not bound to endeavor after universal knowledge, but we are bound to guard against error and to receive nothing that has not the stamp of truth. All truth is not obligatory, but nothing but truth is obligatory on the understanding. No man, under any circumstances, has a right to think a lie. He can no more without guilt administer poison to his understanding than he can administer it to his body. The degree of knowledge which is essential to the discharge of the duties of any sphere in which a man is called to act and to the accomplishment of his destiny as a moral and responsible being is always binding. What the exigencies of our peculiar and distinctive vocations as artisans, laborers, or members of the learned professions demand, and what our general calling as men made in the image of God and destined to happiness or misery in a future state according to our character and conduct here requires, it is incumbent upon all to seek, and it is possible for all to attain. That knowledge which pertains to the conduct of life is accessible to all upon whom the duties of life are imposed. It is the only knowledge which is of universal obligation, and in reference to it there is no need to inquire who shall ascend into heaven or who shall descend into the deep. The word is nigh us even in our hearts and our mouths. The great doctrines of man's duty and destiny are not left to doubtful disputations. They are proclaimed upon an evidence which is open, palpable, authoritative. They stand upon the testimony of God. Wherever the Scriptures are known, it is the imperative duty of all to know Him, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom He has sent. No cares, no business should be allowed to preclude us from the fountain of life. Things temporal must yield to things eternal. Things carnal must give way to the spiritual, the seen and perishing to the unseen and immortal. The Bible must have the precedence of every other book, and though a man could speak with the tongues of angels and understand all mysteries and subdue all nations in obedience to his will, yet if he were destitute of that knowledge which makes him wise unto salvation, with all his boasted attainments, he would be but a chattering fool, but a sounding brass or a tinkling cymbal. This knowledge, then, in its essential elements as bearing upon our destiny as men, is of universal obligation. This pearl of great price we must purchase, though we sacrifice all our other possessions to gain it. With these explanations and limitations, I proceed to point out in what the love of truth essentially consists, and to indicate some of the temptations to which the young particularly are exposed to disregard it. I need not say a word in reference to the importance of these points. With all our commendations of the beauty, the glory, the excellency of truth, it must yet be acknowledged that the temper of mind which is most favorable to the successful pursuit of it is exceedingly rare, even among those whose professed business is to seek and explain it. Composed as men are of conflicting elements, as evidently disordered in their understandings as they are in their affections, liable to the perversions of passion and interest, apt to confound the zeal of prejudice with earnestness of principle, the affectation of vanity with brilliancy of genius, eager for applause, and not always scrupulous about the means of securing it, the last spectacle which they exhibit is the true spirit of philosophy. The motive which least vigorously impels them is the ingenuous love of knowledge. I cannot better introduce what I have to suggest upon the nature of the love of truth, which I have been endeavoring to commend, than in the words of Locke, a competent authority upon this subject, having been himself a distinguished example of the spirit he inculcates. Quote, first, end quote, says he, note Conduct of the Understanding, sections 11 and 12, quote, a man must not be in love with any opinion, or wish it to be true, till he knows it to be so. And then he will not need to wish it, for nothing that is false can deserve our good wishes, nor a desire that it should have the place and force of truth. Secondly, he must do that which he will find himself very averse to, as judging the thing unnecessary or himself incapable of doing it. He must try whether his principles be certainly true or not, and how far he may safely rely upon them. In these two things, vis-a-vis an equal indifferency for all truth, I mean the receiving it, the love of it as truth, but not loving it for any other reason before we know it to be true, and in the examination of our principles, and not receiving any for such, nor building on them till we are fully convinced as rational creatures of their solidity, truth, and certainty, consists that freedom of the understanding which is necessary to a rational creature, and without which it is not truly an understanding. End quote. We are not to confound the indifference of which Locke here speaks as to what is true previous to the discovery with indifference to the truth itself. Neither are we to suppose that he commends a spirit which is at all indifferent to the search after truth. On the other hand, He would have us eager in the pursuit, impartial in our inquiries and established in our conclusions, zealous for truth when truth is found, and ardent in quest of it while it yet lies undiscovered before us, guarding equally against the partiality which would pervert and the lethargy which would arrest the efforts of the understanding. He is a slave to ignorance who is too idle to examine. He is a slave to prejudice who believes without or independently of evidence. An exemption from indolence or apathy on the one hand and all irregular biases on the other, an exemption founded upon the very anxiety to escape from the stagnation of ignorance and the impostures of error, is the freedom of the understanding which Locke, note, Conduct of the Understanding, section 12, end note, pronounces to be essential to a rational nature, without which it may be, quote, conceit, fancy, extravagance, anything, end quote, but not, quote, an understanding, end quote. It is this freedom which constitutes the love of truth, or rather this freedom is the only means by which the love of truth can be exemplified and curiosity directed to its appropriate objects. The whole duty of man in regard to the conduct of his understanding may be referred to the single comprehensive principle that evidence is the measure of assent. This is the light which alone can make it manifest, and by this light, and this light alone, are we commanded to walk. The understanding, as the instrument of truth, has for its guide the laws of belief, and it is in virtue of these laws that it is so admirably adapted to the exercise of intelligence. Truth to us is and can be only relative. Things in their own natures, in their essences and quiddities, we are incapable of apprehending. That alone is truth to us, which the constitution of our nature either immediately or mediately prompts us to believe. Its fundamental condition is confidence in our faculties, and the convictions which are produced in conformity to the laws of our rational nature, the appearances of things to the human understanding when healthfully exercised, these constitute the ultimate measures of truth and falsehood. That is to us which appears to be, and is only in so far as it appears. Beyond these appearances, our faculties can never penetrate. Intelligence, or the apprehension of truth, involves judgment, belief, conviction of certainty, not merely that the thing is there, but, to use a sensible analogy, seen to be there. There must be a constitution of mind adapted to that specific activity by which it believes and judges, as it is only by virtue of such a constitution that the conception of knowledge becomes possible. This preparation of the mind to know, or its adaptation to intelligence, consists in subjecting it to laws of belief under which it must conduct its own operations. Its energies can be exercised only under the condition that it shall know or believe. As it is the necessity of belief which distinguishes intelligent action from every other species of operation, there must exist in the mind as a part of its very structure natural tendencies to certain manners of belief to be developed as soon as its activities are called forth. In their dormant state, as they exist antecedently to experience, they are only necessities of thinking. But developed by experience and generalized into abstract statements, they are original and elementary cognitions, the foundation and criteria of all knowledge. They are the standard of evidence, the constitutive and regulative principles of intelligence, the light of the mind. And without them, the mind could no more be conceived to know than a blind man to see. Through them, we know and believe everything else. They are vouchers and guarantees for all the truth which it falls to the lot of man to apprehend. To regulate belief by evidence is, accordingly, to receive nothing which is not either an original conviction or capable of being resolved into one. As we know by and through the mind, we can only know according to the laws of the mind. All error may consequently be traced to some transgression of the laws of belief. There can be no doubt that, if all the conditions which ought to be observed in the processes of the understanding were faithfully regarded, there would be no danger of fallacy or mistake. Error is the result of disobedience or inattention to the intelligent constitution of our own nature and the punishment of intellectual guilt. To follow nature, as that nature came from the hands of God, is to be conducted to truth as well as to duty. If the primary data of consciousness are the standard and measure of evidence, there are but two ways in which we are liable to be misled and deceived. The first is in assuming as an original conviction or the legitimate product of such convictions what is only the dictate of authority, custom, education, or desire. And the second is in misapplying the data of consciousness to the cases which are actually submitted to the decisions of the understanding. We mistake the real nature of the phenomena and accordingly apply to them laws which are not applicable. In other words, we are liable to err by having a wrong standard of judgment or by using a right standard improperly. These are the heads to which it seems to me all prejudice, however originated, may be at last referred. They give rise to skepticism and falsehood. He who confounds the dictates of education or authority with the primary convictions of nature not only exposes himself to the danger of serious and fatal mistakes, but prepares the way for the utter annihilation of the essential distinctions betwixt truth and falsehood. The origin and nature of skepticism have been admirably described by Sir William Hamilton, note, Philosophical Discourses, article on Brown, end note, quote, "Our knowledge," says he, "rests ultimately on certain facts of consciousness, which, as primitive and consequently incomprehensible, are given less in the form of cognitions than of beliefs. But if consciousness, in its last analysis, in other words, if our primary experience, be a faith, the reality of our knowledge turns on the veracity of our generative beliefs. As ultimate, the quality of these beliefs cannot be inferred. Their truth, however, is, in the first instance, to be presumed. As given and possessed, they must stand good until refuted. Negante incumbent probatio. Intelligence cannot gratuitously annihilate itself. Nature is not to be assumed to work in vain, nor the author of nature to create only to deceive. But though the truths of our instinctive faith must originally be admitted, their falsehood may subsequently be established. This, however, only through themselves, only on the ground of their reciprocal contradiction. Is this contradiction proved? The edifice of our knowledge is undermined. For no lie is of the truth. Consciousness is to the philosopher what the Bible is to the theologian. Both are professed revelations of divine truth. Both exclusively supply the constitutive elements of knowledge and the regulative standard of its construction. Each may be disproved, but disproved only by itself. If one or other reveal facts which, as mutually repugnant, cannot but be false, the authenticity of that revelation is invalidated, and the criticism which signalizes this self-refutation has, in either case, been able to convert assurance into skepticism, to turn the truth of God into a lie. As psychology is only a developed consciousness, the positive philosopher has thus a primary presumption in favor of the elements out of which his system is constructed, while the skeptic or negative philosopher must be content to argue back to the falsehood of those elements from the impossibility which the dogmatist may experience in combining them into the harmony of truth. For truth is one, and the end of philosophy is the intuition of unity. Skepticism is not an original or independent method. It is the correlevant and consequent of dogmatism. And so far from being an enemy to truth, it arises only from a false philosophy as its indication and its cure. The skeptic must not himself establish, but from the dogmatist, accept his principles. And his conclusion is only a reduction of philosophy to zero on the hypothesis of the doctrine from which his premises are borrowed. Are the principles which a peculiar system involves convicted of contradiction, or are these principles proved repugnant to others, which, as facts of consciousness, every positive philosophy must admit? Then is established a relative skepticism, or conclusion that philosophy, so far as realized in this system, is groundless. Again, are the principles which, as facts of consciousness, philosophy in general must comprehend, found exclusive of each other? There is established an absolute skepticism. The impossibility of all philosophy is involved in the negation of the one criterion of truth. Our statement may be reduced to a dilemma. Either the facts of consciousness can be reconciled or they cannot. If they cannot, knowledge absolutely is impossible, and every system of philosophy therefore false. If they can, no system which supposes their inconsistency can pretend to truth. End quote. It is the office of the skeptic to bring the different powers of the soul into a state of unnatural collision and to set our faculties at war, to involve their functions in suspicion, to make the deductions of the understanding contradict original convictions of nature, or these original convictions contradict themselves in the conclusions they legitimate, and thus to sap the foundations of knowledge, to annihilate all certainty, to reduce truth and falsehood to a common insignificance, and expose the mind to endless perplexity, confusion, and despair. The danger of receiving as maxims what are not entitled to the dignity extends much beyond the immediate errors in which they involve us. It is not that they generate a rash dogmatism, but that they afford the materials of undermining the whole temple of knowledge, which creates their mischief. The skeptic accepts them at the hands of the dogmatist and uses them as instruments of death. Hence the importance in the language of Locke, note Conduct of the Understanding, section 44, end note, of accustoming ourselves, quote, in any question proposed to examine and find out upon what it bottoms. Most of the difficulties that come in our way, when well considered and traced, lead us to some proposition which, known to be true, clears the doubt and gives an easy solution of the question, end quote. The mischief which maxims rashly accepted as intuitive judgments or well-drawn conclusions have done to the cause of truth, both in philosophy and religion, is incalculable. A single crotchet of philosophers that the relation of knowledge implies an analogy of the subject and the object involved for centuries the whole subject of perception and the mode of our knowledge of the external world in confusion, hypothesis, and contradiction. The ideal theory was the offspring of this simple proposition, and it might even yet retain its ascendancy in the schools if the skepticism of Hume, at once the indication and cure of the disorder, had not arisen and prepared the way for a sounder metaphysics. The scribes and Pharisees took it to be a maxim that no good thing could come out of Nazareth, and upon the absurd dogma founded the belief that Jesus was an impostor. The soft enthusiast receives it as an axiom that the benevolence of God rejoices in the happiness of his creatures simply and for itself, and hence proceeds to the denial of government, and especially the operations of penal justice. It deserves to be particularly remarked that the mind very frequently assumes, without the formality of distinct enunciation, as self-evident truths, a class of propositions from which it would recoil if stated in words. It silently and imperceptibly takes them for granted. They enter into its reasonings without its being distinctly conscious of their presence. Some men are tenacious of opinions because they are the characteristics of a party or a sect, because they are recommended by high authority and have been sanctioned by a long, uninquiring acquiescence. Quote, when any of these maxims are brought to the test, end quote, no man who pretends to reason will hesitate to condemn them as fallible and uncertain and, quote, such, end quote, as Mr. Locke expresses it, note, Conduct of the Understanding, Section 6, end note, quote, as he will not allow in those that differ from him, and yet after he is convinced of this, you shall see him go on in the use of them, and the very next occasion that offers, argue again upon the same grounds, end quote. The criteria by which the fundamental data of consciousness are recognized are sufficiently plain for all the purposes of life. The difficulty consists not in their obscurity or confusion, but in their own reluctance to examine the grounds of our belief, and to bring every proposition to the law and to the testimony. We love opinions instead of truth. We are pleased with dogmas upon other and independent grounds, and are insensibly led by our passions and desires to transform ourselves from candid and impartial inquirers into earnest and interested advocates. Education makes authority tantamount to nature, and we quietly treat as intuitively obvious what we caught from the nursery and cradle without having ever seriously asked ourselves whether these principles are indeed distinguished by the marks and characters of original convictions. Hence, error is perpetuated from age to age. One generation transmits a legacy of lies to another, and the dreams of tranquility are not disturbed until some threatening form of skepticism arises that compels examination and enforces inquiry. The first duty, therefore, which the love of truth exacts at our hands is to look well to our principles, to prove all things, and to hold fast that which is good. Bring everything to the standard of evidence which our nature supplies. This is the only light which we are at liberty to follow. A blind and implicit reception of any principles, however sacred, without satisfactory evidence, is alike condemned by the Scriptures and the voice of reason. This mechanical faith is not an exercise of the understanding. It is a passive acquiescence in the circumstances which surround us. Such a man does not think. He is thought for. He simply crams himself with the cogitations of other minds, as a cook crams a bird with food. Let a man be rigidly indifferent as to what shall prove to be truth. Keep all passion, interest, or disturbing influences at a distance, and patient examination will most certainly conduct him to the light of real evidence. The other form in which prejudice operates is by distorting the appearance of things so as to make us upon true principles pronounce wrong judgments. Our faculties are not put in complete possession of the case. This is especially true of moral and religious subjects. In all such subjects, the evidence is tinged by the complexion of the mind, and although the judgment may be right according to the evidence as presented, it is not right according to the evidence as it exists in itself. It is a jaundiced eye misjudging of colors. That there is a connection betwixt the state of the soul and the perception of moral and divine truth was a principle admitted even by the heathen philosophers. Aristotle expressly announces it, and the celebrated fable of the wolf learning to read was especially designed to illustrate it. Depravity of heart and the indulgence of corrupt and wicked passions not only give rise to false measures of truth, but false applications of the true measures of good and evil. In this double operation consists what the Scriptures denominate the deceitfulness of sin. Things are represented in disguise, bitter put for sweet, sweet for bitter. And through the fatal force and imposture of words, the fraud is concealed and propagated. Thus, parsimony may have the credit of frugality, and a spirit of revenge be dignified as sensibility to honor, and extravagance or prodigality receive the praise which is due to liberality. The passions make out a false case, and hence a false judgment is necessarily rendered. The ablest advocate of the passions on such occasions is the power of association. Let unpleasant ideas be connected with a name, and they will be transferred to everything to which the name is applied. A slaveholder at the North is the very embodiment of evil, and an abolitionist at the South an emissary of darkness. It is a trick of politicians to bandy epithets, words being the counters of wise men but the coin of fools. You might not be able to injure a man's principles, but call him some hateful name, and you effectually destroy him. There is no subject in regard to which the young should be more constantly on their guard than the sophistry of the heart. In a right-ordered mind, adaptation to its state is the highest evidence of good, and when the heart is corrupt, the things which are suitable to it will still be prized as objects of desire, and invested with all those properties and attributes which belong to real excellence. It will still make analogy or correspondence to its prevailing tastes and inclinations the practical criterion of truth. As the relation of assent can never freely and cheerfully obtain where the mind and proposition are not homogeneous, sympathy being in this, as in all other cases, essential to union, it is clear that wickedness has a fearful power in seducing the understanding into error. It has but to seize upon the principle of fitness to make the feeling of proportion to its own tastes, of correspondence and congruity with its own dispositions or desires, the measure of good, in order to fill the mind with prejudices and to erect a standard of practical truth which must fatally pervert the judgment. Taylor has well observed that, quote, a man's mind must be like your proposition before it can be entertained, for whatever you put into a man, it will smell of the vessel. It is a man's mind that gives the emphasis and makes your argument to prevail, end quote. Hence, as the same eloquent writer again remarks, quote, it is not the wit of man, but the spirit of a man, not so much his head as his heart, that learns the divine philosophy, end quote. Moral is not more distinguished from mathematical reasoning by the fact that it admits of degrees than by the equally important fact that these degrees may be indefinitely modified by our tempers, dispositions, and habits. Even the transient humor in which we may chance to be has often a controlling influence. The same circumstance, which in one state of mind would carry no weight with it, in another might amount to a very high degree of certainty, just as in one state of mind a phenomenon may be eminently suggestive, which in another would pass unheeded. Newton, no doubt, had often seen apples fall, but the event was insignificant until he happened to be in a particular vein of speculation, quote, trifles, end quote, which to the generous and unsuspecting seem, quote, light as air, are to the jealous confirmation strong as proof of holy writ, end quote. While, therefore, it is true that a man's faith will always be according to his apprehension of the evidence, it is not true that in moral subjects the evidence will always be apprehended in its just proportions. It may be perverted, distorted, discolored, or reduced to nothing. The facts which contain it may fail to suggest it, or suggest it feebly and inadequately. To a man under the habitual dominion of covetousness, it is impossible to represent in its true light an enterprise of charity. To a glutton lost in sensuality, or a sot reduced to the condition of a brute, all discourses upon man's sublime gifts must be unmeaning. The voluptuary and debauchee cannot comprehend the dignity and excellence of self-denial. The proud will turn in disgust from lessons of humility, and the envious sneer at the obligation of benevolence. It is an universal rule that sin darkens the understanding while it corrupts the heart. It is as inconsistent with the just appreciation of evidence as with the faithful discharge of duty. Hence, it was a custom in the ancient schools of philosophy to spend some time in trials and examinations of the genius and disposition of their scholars before they admitted them to the sublime instructions of the sect. The Platonists, particularly, laid down severe rules for, quote, the purgation of the soul, for refining and purifying it from the contagion of the body, and the infection it might have contracted from the sensitive life, in order to fit and prepare it for the contemplation of intellectual and abstract truths, end quote. One greater than Plato or Aristotle, the master of a nobler philosophy than ever sprang from earth, has enjoined it as a condition of knowing divine truth, that we cultivate the spirit of universal obedience. He that will do God's will shall know of the doctrine. There is no principle which needs to be more strenuously inculcated then that evidence alone should be the measure of assent. In reference to this principle, the whole discipline of the understanding must be conducted. Our anxiety should be to guard against all the influences which preclude the access of evidence, incapacitate us to appreciate its value, and give false measures of judgment instead of the natural and legitimate laws of belief. All real evidence we are bound to receive according to the weight which it would have in a sound and healthful condition of the soul. It is a defect in the mind not to be able to appreciate its lowest degrees. That is a feeble and must be a fickle mind which, foolishly demanding certainty on all the questions submitted to its judgment, cannot proportion its faith to the amount of light it enjoys. Dissatisfied with probability and ever in quest of what the circumstances of our case put hopelessly beyond our reach, such men, like Noah's dove, will seek in vain for a spot on which they can rest. Probability is the guide of life, and he who resolves to believe nothing but what he can demonstrate acts in open defiance of the condition of sublunary existence. There are many things here which we can only see through a glass darkly. Our duty is to walk by the light which we have. God commands us to yield to all evidence that is real in precise proportion to its strength. Evidence, and that alone, he has made it obligatory on our understandings to pursue. And whatever opinions we hold that are not the offspring of evidence, that have come to us merely from education, authority, custom, or passion, however true and valuable they may be in themselves, are not held by us in the spirit of truth. These measures of assent are only presumptions, which should stimulate inquiry and breed modesty and caution. They are helps to our faith, but should never be made the props of it. Hence, all efforts to restrict freedom of debate and the liberty of the press should be watched with caution as prejudicial to the eliciting of evidence and the defense and propagation of the truth. But little is gained if opinions are crammed into men, and this is likely to be the case where they are not permitted to inquire and to doubt. At the same time, it must be remembered that no spirit is more unfriendly to that indifference of mind so essential to freedom of inquiry than that which arises in the conduct of controversy. When we become advocates, we lay aside the garb of philosophers. The desire of victory is often stronger than the love of truth, and pride, jealousy, ambition, and envy, identifying ourselves with our opinions, will lend their aid to pervert our judgments and to seduce us from our candor. A disputatious spirit is always the mark of a little mind. The cynic may growl, but he can never aspire to dignity of character. There are undoubtedly occasions when we must contend earnestly for the truth, but when we buckle on the panoply of controversy, we should look well to our own hearts, that no motives animate us but the love of truth and zeal for the highest interests of man. I am apt to suspect that the habit, which is not unfrequently recommended as a means of intellectual discipline, of arguing on the wrong side of a question as a trial of ingenuity and skill, is inconsistent with ingenuousness of mind. It is sporting with falsehood, trifling with evidence, and must eventually produce a fondness for sophistry, which will ultimately destroy solidity of judgment. Besides this, to use arguments as conclusive, which we do not believe to be possessed of that character, is very near to a deliberate lie. It is a practice closely allied to pious frauds. But the most serious dangers to which a young man is exposed of surrendering the interests of truth are those which arise from vanity or shame. The love of applause, which, studious only of appearances, substitutes hypocrisy for virtue, rashness for courage, and pedantry for learning, will court reputation rather from the glitter of paradox than the steady light of truth. He whose end is to elicit admiration, who aims to seem not to be a philosopher, will prefer plausibility to evidence, ingenuity to reasoning, and singularity to general consent. When the ambition of notoriety, which ought not to occupy the subordinate position of an incidental motive, usurps the place of an end of inquiry, its disturbing influences upon the integrity of the mind are not less disastrous than the effects of ostentation in morals upon the sincerity of the heart. The laws of evidence cease to be regarded. Novelty, not truth, becomes a measure of assent. Astonishment, not conviction, the aim of argument. And the stare of wonder is deemed a more pleasing tribute than substantial esteem. The excursions of this insane principle are marked by opposition to the settled opinions of the race, fierce and malignant in proportion to their worth, and by a prolific ingenuity in the invention of error. As the reputation of sagacity and superior discernment is the prize to be won, he promises to be the most successful competitor who triumphs over the general persuasion of mankind, who detects flaws and elements of falsehood in the faith of generations, and rears a new fabric of wisdom and knowledge upon the ruins of ancient ignorance and superstition. To such men, nothing is venerable, nothing sacred. They penetrate the depths of the past to collect the mischievous opinions which time had consigned to oblivion, and to reproduce upon the stage in the dress of novelty the actors that once inspired consternation and alarm. They explore the mysteries of science, not to admire the wisdom or adore the goodness of God, not to enlarge the dominion of mankind, to relieve their wants, to increase their comforts, to stimulate their piety and exalt their destiny, but to wring from the secrets of nature by hateful processes of torture some dubious confessions that may signalize themselves as unexpected ministers of ill. As religion is the most awful subject that can occupy the thoughts of men, it is here that the encroachments of vanity will be most daring and presumptuous. Science is the possession of but few, and he who ventures upon novelties in any of its departments can expect but a limited glory. Religion, on the other hand, is the property of the race, and he who should succeed in confounding its principles or extinguishing its sanctions would achieve a conquest which, if the extent of ruin is to be the measure of renown, might satisfy the largest ambition. It is a marvelous phenomenon that men should be willing to relieve obscurity by infamy, that rather than not be known, they will deliberately suppress the light of reason, quell the remonstrances of conscience, forfeit the approbation of the wise and good, defy the omnipotent to arms, and run the risk of everlasting damnation. Yet such there are, infatuated men, who seek for distinction and unnatural efforts to degrade their species, who found a title to respect upon discoveries which link them in destiny to the brutes, who glory in their shame. Nothing in the majesty of virtue rebukes them. Nothing in the simplicity of truth allures them. Nothing in the terrors of the Almighty alarms them. With ruthless violence and parasitical zeal, they attack whatever is venerable, sacred, august, and true. The sublimest doctrines of religion, the dread retributions of eternity, and the name and perfections of him who sits upon the circle of the earth and before whom the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers and the nations are counted as the small dust of the balance, are treated as materials to minister to vanity. At one time, under the pretext of exalting natural religion, the mysteries of the cross are disregarded, and reason is professedly exalted only that grace may be really despised. At another time, the distinctions of truth and falsehood are involved in confusion, and universal skepticism made the touchstone of sound philosophy, and truth and duty and religion disappear in the darkness. The scene changes, and we behold open apologists for atheism, who seek to gain a name in the earth by unblushingly proclaiming that they can detect no traces of wisdom in the fabric of the world, no tokens of goodness in the conduct of providence, whose deity is chance, whose devotion is sensuality, whose hope is extinction. But as these gross forms of impiety and absurdity soon excited too much disgust to flatter the vanity of their authors, the infamous odor they emitted rebuking the inspection of curiosity, this miserable ambition of distinction was compelled to resort to decency, and assuming the air of profound speculation, covered its enormities under the refinements of a philosophy in which names that are dear to the heart, the names of God, of virtue and religion, are retained, but the things themselves are exploded. This system is exactly adapted to the ruling passion of the vain. Obscurity is its element, and as objects look larger in a mist, the reputation of profound sagacity and wisdom may be cheaply purchased by substituting mystery for sense and dreams for thought, by drinking inspiration from the clouds and clothing oracular responses in a jargon as dark and unintelligible as the hieroglyphics of those great exemplars of imposture, the priesthood of Egypt. Guard against vanity. Never let it be a question whether this or that opinion shall attract attention to your persons. Look only for evidence. Follow the light. Be content with the reflection that you have deserved, whether you have gained or not the approbation of your fellows. Wisdom will eventually be justified of all her children. The triumphs of vanity are short, those of truth, everlasting. Closely connected with vanity is the irregular influence of the sense of shame in prompting us to shrink from opinions which may expose us to ridicule. False shame, it is obvious, however, is not so fatal to the interests of truth as vanity, since, content with suppressing unpopular convictions, it makes no excursions into the fields of error. Unambitious of attracting observation, it meditates no monument of glory. It is not obscurity, but contempt, that excites its apprehensions. The sense of shame as a subsidiary sanction of virtue and propriety is an important, perhaps an indispensable, element in the economy of human nature. It is a protection from what is little in principle and mean in conduct. But to exalt the sense of the ridiculous into a criterion of truth, to make it the guide of reason in the pursuits of philosophy, is to destroy the just subordination of impulses and passions to the dictates of the understanding. Our emotions depend not upon the essential qualities of the objects that excite them, but upon the representations that are made to the mind. The eye affects the heart. The aspects or lights in which things are contemplated determine the character of the feelings they produce. If, then, virtue and truth are capable of being distorted by the fancy they presented under false appearances, they are capable of being made the occasions of emotions foreign to their nature. It may, indeed, be conceded that the sense of ridicule is an instinct of nature, and that its appropriate qualities are neither truth, virtue, nor goodness, distinctively as such. But as instances of virtue can be misrepresented to the moral sense and receive the censure which is due to vice, so truth can be covered in the disguise of falsehood and provoke the laughter which is due to folly. The intrinsic dignity and importance of an object are no exemption from the shafts of raillery. The noblest painting may be seen in a false light. The history of infidelity is fraught with melancholy proof that no subjects are too sublime for levity, too sacred for caricature, or too solemn for a jest. Could religion always be presented in its true colors, and this is a truth which it is most important to guard, it would have nothing to fear from the power of ridicule. But when piety is denounced as superstition, humility reproached as meanness, faith derided as enthusiasm, firmness despised as obstinacy, and joy in the Holy Ghost insulted as the offspring of spiritual pride, religion may suffer from the contempt due only to the gross and disgusting pictures which sophists and buffoons have drawn of it. There are a thousand tricks by which wit and humor may pervert the mysteries of the cross and connect them with low and ridiculous associations with which they have no natural affinity. Through the fatal imposture of words, by mean and vulgar analogies, the eccentricities of good men may be artfully exaggerated, their ignorance and frailties conspicuously set off, and true piety dexterously confounded with hypocrisy and fraud. In every age, skeptics have relied more upon the power of sarcasm than upon the power of argument. The enemies of Christianity, as Dr. Paley justly remarks, have pursued her with poisoned weapons. A sophism may be detected, but who can refute a sneer? When infidelity ceased to be confined to the circles of philosophers and began to court the approbation of the crowd, it abandoned whatever dignity and elegance it formerly possessed and descended to the lowest forms of buffoonery. It dropped the mask of the sage, assumed the character of the harlequin, relinquished argument, and betook itself to ribaldry. The design of the French philosophers was not to discuss the merits of Christianity, but to present it in false lights, to exhibit it in uncouth and revolting attitudes, to attach disgusting or ridiculous associations with its peculiar doctrines, and to cover it with a contempt which was due only to the odious pictures themselves had drawn. It has been the trick of the profane in every age to deride pretensions to spiritual religion, and it requires no ordinary degree of courage to resist the contempt to which the profession of vital religion is exposed in the world. When it is industriously connected with ideas of littleness, meanness, and fanaticism, represented as the property of narrow spirits and of coward hearts, the temptation is very strong to be ashamed of its doctrines, its promises, and its hopes. Such is the depravity of men that singular virtue is made the object of reproach, while singular vice or singular error may be the means of distinction. Hence our Savior brings the awful sanctions of eternity to bear upon those who are in danger of surrendering truth to a jest, their honest opinions to raillery and banter. He points to a shame with which sin shall be finally accompanied, more tremendous and appalling than all the reproaches of men, an everlasting contempt which shall astonish and overwhelm the guilty when God shall laugh at his calamity and mock when his fear cometh. Quote, "Whosoever is ashamed of me and of my words, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he comes in the glory of the Father with the holy angels." End quote. We should particularly guard against the irregular influence of shame, because its operations do not always stop at the suppression or concealment of obnoxious opinions. The rebukes of conscience must be silenced by pleas, and the self-respect we have forfeited must be regained by evasions. He who is ashamed of the truth will soon proceed to condemn it. He who is afraid to profess Christ will soon be tempted to deny him. He that is not prepared to suffer will soon be induced to betray. that character alone is great, in which the love of truth is supreme, habitually superior to the clamors of prejudice, the surmises of ignorance, and the jeers of contempt. I have now described briefly and rapidly the characteristics of the love of truth, which was previously evinced to be a duty, and pointed out some of the dangers to which we are exposed of foregoing its claims. My design has been to commend this spirit to your hearts. It is the foundation of all solid excellence. It gives stability to character and distinguishes firmness from obstinacy. It makes a man of principle. You may be distinguished in the world without it, but you never can have the approbation of your own hearts or the smile of God. You never can perfect and adorn your natures. Learn to investigate, to examine, to try the principles that are proposed to you, and make it a fixed rule to regulate your assent by no authority but that of evidence. Never be in love with opinions upon any foreign or adventitious grounds. Cleave to them only because they are the truth. Hear instruction and be wise and refuse it not. Blessed, says divine wisdom, is the man that heareth me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at the posts of my doors. For whoso findeth me findeth life, and shall obtain favor of the Lord. But he that sinneth against me wrongeth his own soul. All they that hate me love death.
Thank you for listening to this message from Antioch Presbyterian Church. For more information about Antioch, visit us at our website at antiochpca.com.